Well, good evening. Am I on? You can hear me? Good. Okay. Yes, this is the title that David chose for me, although we did negotiate. But if you don't like the title, then you know who to blame. But this is really an opportunity for us to think through a little bit about faith sharing, but about faith sharing in context. What does it mean to share faith in a world that is changing and a culture that is in transition? One of the signs that our culture is in transition, if you read social commentators, if you read people who reflect on our culture, is the number of words you encounter that begin with post. Can you think of any? Post-Brexit, huh? Okay, we're starting well tonight. Post-modern, yep, whatever that means, and nobody quite knows. Post-millennial, okay. Yeah, there are a few that aren't quite so useful. Post office, not really helpful for us, but post-Christendom is the one we're going to be looking at particularly tonight. Yes, well done. Post-industrial, post-colonial, post-imperial, post-truth was the word of the year last year, apparently. What's interesting about these post-words is that they tell us pretty much nothing about where we're going. They mean afterwards. All the post-words are looking backwards. They're telling us where we used to be. And they're signaling to us that something is changing. And so there's a humility about these words. They're not claiming too much. They're not saying, oh, we can tell you exactly what this new culture is going to be like. They're simply saying, look out, things are changing. We're not where we used to be. The things that we could take for granted, we can no longer take for granted. The familiar landmarks of our culture are disappearing into the mist, and we can't quite see yet what's emerging. So they're helpful in the sense that they mark a transition, they're limited, and they don't tell us very much about where we're heading. And so the term post-Christendom that we're going to be looking at tonight is simply one of those terms. Post-Christendom is not a word describing the future that we're moving into, it's a word about transition. And post-Christendom means a whole range of different things. Let me just highlight a few of these. I'm sure these will be familiar to you. This is just simply a way perhaps of naming things that we see and we know around us. One of the features of our changing culture, one of the things that we perhaps want to identify with post-Christendom, and by the way, we will ask what Christendom was that we're now post in just a moment, but we'll get there. One of the features is that we are moving into a culture where increasingly our story is becoming unknown. We're moving into a context where we can no longer take for granted that people know anything at all of the Bible story, the Bible characters, theological language. Most of what we sung this evening will be incomprehensible to many people. No idea what we're singing about or talking about. The words mean very little. Our story is unknown. Now, that is a fairly new reality. Go back 40, 50 years, and the majority of people would have known something of the story. It might be garbled, it might be partial, but you talk about David or Moses or Solomon or Jesus, and people would have some idea of what you're talking about. Increasingly, we're moving into a context where that isn't the case. Now, it varies. It varies partly across generations. So those of us who are 50, 60 plus, probably most of our peers would still know something. For a younger generation, that probably isn't the case. My wife and I had an interesting experience just around the Christmas time. We now live in Canterbury, and at the Gulbenkian Theatre up the road from us in the University of Kent, they have a variety of musical events. And this particular one was a group doing sort of medieval and folk carols. So just a relaxed evening. And the majority of the people there were sort of our age or even older. And what was interesting was that they finished up with Hark the Herald Angels Sing. So having done lots of medieval carols, they decided to have one that the audience could join in with. And you know, without the words, the vast majority of people were able to sing Hark the Herald Angels Sing. And we were quite interested in that. But we thought, 25, 30 years from now, I don't think that's going to happen. You need the words. Our symbols are becoming unfamiliar. What symbols have you got here in the church? You've got a sun and a moon. Well, yeah, they'd be recognizable. What's that strange thing at the back? A dove? A cross? A star? A fish on the back of the car? That just means someone's interested in fishing, doesn't it? the symbols that we take for granted as marking out our buildings, our places, are increasingly becoming unfamiliar. We can't take for granted that people understand that, or that they know what on earth goes on in a building like this. And it's not just ancient cathedral-type buildings, it's even modern church buildings like this. What on earth goes on inside? What happens in here? What do you do if you go in? Why would you go in the first place? The idea that church going is normal is fading within our culture. The idea that people who have spiritual questions would think of going to church to find out is becoming increasingly unlikely. And that's difficult for us because, you know, this is our home. This is where we belong. When we come to worship, we come to meet with one another. We sort of assume that this is a place people will feel welcome. Now, I didn't notice your notice board outside. Does it say something like, all welcome? Or you don't know, do you? You're so familiar with it, you haven't looked. Many churches have something like, all welcome, everyone welcome outside. And, you know, my guess is that churches generally mean that. They're not trying to be unwelcoming. But the sense that people would come in and know what's going on, know where to sit, what to do, increasingly it's alien. Many people will not feel welcome. And so evangelistic strategies, we're thinking about sharing faith this evening, evangelistic strategies that are rooted in the idea of trying to get people into our building are a bit of a non-starter. This is not the way it's going to happen in the future. It's going to happen out there rather than in here. They may eventually come here, but it's not going to be for a while. And our influence is diminishing. And sometimes Christians get cross about that. We ought to be heard. We want our voice to count. But actually, in a plural society, our influence on policy, on law, on ways of thinking, on values, is diminishing. We do not have the clout that we used to have. It's as simple as that. And we're moving into a situation where a growing number of people describe themselves as non-religious. Only recently have the 10-year censuses asked the religious question. For many decades before that, you didn't say what your religion was. But the last two times, 2001, 2011, you were given the opportunity to state your religion. And some Christians celebrated the fact that still over 50% of the population ticked Christian at that point. Whatever they meant by that, given that church going is about 6%, there seems a bit of a gap. Did it mean not Muslim? Did it mean British? Or even English? I don't know. Not sure what it meant. But the decrease has been year on year since then. We are moving into a situation where the majority of people would not claim Christian identity, even in the vaguest sense. And a growing number of people, that's the area of growth within our context, are saying, I'm not religious. They wouldn't necessarily say not spiritual, but they would certainly say not religious. Don't believe in dogma. Don't believe in institutions. Some express interest in spirituality. Again, it's difficult to know quite what that means. It means all sorts of things. It usually is fairly chaotic, unprocessed. It seems sometimes a bit like a fashion accessory. If you look at popular magazines, the spirituality section seems to be with food and clothing. It's that sort of area. It's not the kind of central stuff. It's the add-ons, if you want those. But, of course, there is also the growth of other religions. We are moving into a religiously plural society. So to describe our context as secular is only partly true. It's a secular and multi-religious context. Partly through immigration, but partly also through the growth of communities that have other faiths. And partly also through conversion. People are becoming Muslims or becoming Buddhists in our culture. English people are. And so there's just a kind of religious turmoil going on at the moment. None of those things were true to the same extent 30, 40 years ago. Within the lifetime of many of us, these things have been emerging. Familiar? I didn't think I was saying anything new. All I'm doing is naming things that I'm sure you're familiar with. And they're more advanced in some places than others. I don't know Thornbury very well. I lived in Bristol for 10 years, but, you know, that's down the road. So I don't know your context. I don't know how much of these things are true here, but they are increasingly true in most parts of the country. And the transition is continuing. So we need to dig a bit deeper into that in a moment and ask, well, what are the implications of that for sharing faith? What does this mean for us as Christians? How do we engage this complex, changing and plural society with the good news of Jesus Christ. But before we do that, we need to do what I suggested earlier. If we're going to talk about post-Christendom, we need to look back to what Christendom was before we get there. Where were we? What was it like? What were the features of it? How do we understand Christendom? Well, the first thing to say was that Christendom was a place. It was a part of the world. It was a geographical area. And for much of the last 1,000 years, it was essentially the same as Europe. Europe was the Christian part of the world. Beyond Christendom was heathendom, and there be dragons. That's a dangerous area. The only people that go there are traders, soldiers, and missionaries, sometimes sadly altogether. And of course, that Christendom world was then exported to other parts of the world, to North America, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. But for many hundreds of years, Christendom and Europe were basically the same place. And within the boundaries of Christendom, the assumption, the working assumption was, everyone's Christian. Never true, entirely. There was always the Jewish community, and we treated them pretty badly. In the south of Europe, there were Muslims. There were always some people who we might today call agnostics or atheists. In those days, they were called free thinkers, which I find intriguing. They chose not to believe. That was tough in Christendom. You were meant to believe certain things. A free thinker was someone who dissented. Now, good Baptists should have sympathy with dissenters. It's part of the tradition. These were the dissenters in Christendom. But in Christendom, you wouldn't go up to somebody and say, oh, are you a Christian? It was just taken for granted. You were odd if you weren't. Within the boundaries, this was meant to be a Christian society. It was also a time. There was a time before it, and I think we are emerging into a time after it. For the first nearly three centuries, there was no Christendom. Christians emerged out of a small renewal movement within Judaism, gradually spread across the north and south coasts of the Mediterranean, spread also into Asia, which is another story altogether. And gradually the church became established in villages and towns and cities across the Roman Empire. But on the margins, powerless, not at the center. Not influential, subject to sporadic persecution, not persecuted the whole time, but you never quite knew what the knock on the door was going to mean. It was an uncertain time to be a follower of Jesus. And then something very odd happened, something which the early Christians weren't expecting. There's no evidence whatsoever in the early writings that what happened at the beginning of the 4th century was ever anticipated. The emperor got converted. The Roman Emperor Constantine decided that he wanted to identify himself as a Christian. And more than that, he wanted to turn the Roman Empire from pagan to Christian. Amazing shock to the system. Suddenly, the emperor wants to identify as a Christian. Long and complicated story, but over the coming decades and then centuries, the pagan empire was transformed into a supposedly Christian empire, where the church is invited into the center, becomes powerful and wealthy, and is able to dominate society, is able to get its will done, able to pass the laws it wants passing, because the emperor and a succession of emperors are on its side. So for about 1600 years in Europe, we have had this Christendom, we have had this Christian society with the church at the heart, the church at the center. It's only part of the story. As I mentioned earlier, the church went east as well as west. And so the church in Asia has a very different story. It's not a story we know very well. Excuse me, I've been teaching all weekend. And a drink of water will be very helpful. Thank you. And I'm coughing down the microphone, which doesn't help you either. The church went east. Missionaries went east into Asia as well. It's been estimated that there were probably more Asian Christians in the Middle Ages than European Christians. But it's an unknown story. We tend to think of church history from a Western perspective. And when the church went into Asia, it didn't have a Constantine. It didn't have that same journey. And so what we're talking about this evening is very much the kind of Western European part of the church story. It's not the whole thing. But for hundreds of years, historians described what was emerging as Christendom. And Christendom, by the way, just means Christ's domain, where Christ is king. It's actually a way of saying the kingdom's come. kingdom that we pray for in the Lord's Prayer. Oh, it's come. Here it is, Christendom. But how Christian was it? Thank you, David. But it was a very impressive civilization. We're talking about something that was all-embracing. The whole of life was embraced in this kind of Christian civilization. The Christian story, Christian language, Christian art, Christian architecture. The whole of civilization was imbued with the Christian story. And in many ways, Christendom enabled Europe to survive the chaos at the end of the Roman Empire. As the empire broke down and lots of little states emerged, in many ways it was Christendom that held it all together. So Christendom was by no means entirely a bad thing. I'm going to say some fairly negative things about it shortly, but I want to affirm that actually there were very good things about it. It was a brilliant civilization, and its legacy will be with us for as long as we can imagine. But you lived in a society where everything was shaped by the story that you knew and believed. It's a kind of... Are you listeners to The Archers? Well, I don't follow The Archers. My wife does a bit. And I gather it's, you know, got a bit racy in recent years. But, you know, you go back a few decades and you find a kind of, this is what England should be like kind of situation. Well, in many ways, Christendom was a very comfortable place to live if you weren't a dissenter. If you were a dissenter, you were in real trouble. But if you believed what most people believed, if you did what most people did, it was a fairly congenial place to be. At the heart of it was a political arrangement. It was a partnership between church and empire, or between church and the various nation states that emerged. And it was a partnership that was meant to have mutual benefits. So if you were a political leader and you wanted to declare war on some other state, it was really helpful to have the church behind you blessing the bombs and blessing the weapons and saying, you are on God's side, God is on your side. This is a holy war. You know, that really did sort of buoy up the troops, didn't it? Or if you were a church leader and you wanted to outlaw something you regarded as immoral, it was really helpful to be able to call on the powers of the state to pass a law to make it criminal. So it wasn't just a question of teaching people, it was forcing them to behave in certain ways with penalties. So there was mutual benefit, supposedly. Never a very easy arrangement. There was always a certain amount of tension. Sometimes the Pope dominated the Emperor, sometimes the Emperor dominated the Pope. But it lasted and lasted and lasted. And of course, we still have in this country a state church. We still have the Queen as the head of the Church of England. And there are still state churches in different parts of Europe. And they're incredibly intertwined with each other. It is possible to disestablish. So the Lutheran Church in Sweden, the state church in Sweden, disestablished in the year 2000. It became a free church. There are calls within the Church of England, have been for some years now, for the Church of England to become a free church, to be disestablished from the state. What's quite interesting is that it's mainly Anglicans that want that to happen. They, not many of them do, but those that are calling for it are largely Anglicans. Most other people are quite happy with the state church. It's really interesting. Muslims and Jews, representatives of their communities, it seems they'd much rather live under a kind of insipid Anglicanism than they would a secular state. They regard that as actually a much easier environment. It's surprising how many Baptists think that having a state church is a good idea. I don't know whether anybody here thinks that, but quite a number of Baptists seem to think, oh, we're really glad we're not the state church. You know, we're Baptists, but it's quite good to have one there, isn't it? Interesting. Deeper than any of those things, deeper than all those arrangements, and even when most of the rest of this begins to be fading into the past, I would suggest that Christendom is a way of thinking. It's an ideology. It's a mindset. It's a way of understanding what God is doing in the world. It's a way of understanding how history ought to turn out. And that will persist much longer than much of the rest. So even if we no longer have a state church, even if many of the trappings of Christian civilization begin to fade, even if, as already is true, the boundaries of Christendom make no sense whatsoever, the ideology and the mindset, I think, will last for quite a lot longer. We are not typical Christians here this evening. The typical Christian is black, African, poor. We are now the exception to the rule. The old boundaries of Christendom have disintegrated. We have far more missionaries coming to the West now than going from the West. We're in a very different era. But the ideology, the mindset, is likely to continue. So that was something about what Christendom was, and you know, I could spend several days talking about that, but I won't. But just to give you a kind of flavour, there were brilliant aspects of Christendom, but you know, it was also a brutal culture. It was a totalitarian society. You had to believe the right things. You were in trouble if you were a heretic. You had to behave in certain ways, and you had to belong. You were meant to go to church. You could be fined for not going to church in Christendom. Now, there's an interesting strategy for evangelism. Try it out in Thornbury and see what responses you get. A controlled society. That's long gone, isn't it? This is my attempt at a one-sentence definition of post-Christendom. I'll take a drink while you read it. It's a bulky sentence. It covers a lot of ground, but if you read Paul's writings in the New Testament, he has some incredibly long sentences, some of which have no grammatical sense whatsoever. This is saying a number of things. Post-Christendom is the culture that emerges as the Christian faith loses coherence within a society that has been definitively shaped by the Christian story and as the institutions that have been developed to express Christian convictions decline in influence. So what we're talking about is a society that is losing its roots. A society that was definitively shaped by the Christian story. Now, there were other shaping influences. It was never entirely Christian. And much of the time, it was probably quite nominally Christian. But nevertheless, the Christian story shaped it. And we are moving into a situation where that story is no longer the major shaping influence because people don't know it and don't believe it. And so we're losing the foundations on which much of our society has been based. And that means everything's shaking. And I think you can see that in much of the political discourse at the moment. There's no real sense of why we're doing what we're doing, where we're going, what matters. There's a kind of vacuum of values in our culture. And because that is happening, many of the institutions are being shaken and are losing their role, their influence, including the churches. The churches are no longer where they used to be. By the way, if you want these slides, I'm very happy to leave them with David in case you are interested in this and don't want to copy stuff down. So just to go back to what I was saying about the post-words, they signal transition, not the end of a journey. And so I want to suggest that there are seven transitions that we need to think carefully about, and you will see, I hope, that all these feed into the question, how do we share faith? So the first transition is from the center to the margins. It's the reverse of what happened in the 4th and 5th century, when the church came in from the margins to the center. Over the last few decades, we have gradually been moved out from the center to the margins. We're a marginal community. We're not where we used to be. We were the overwhelming majority. There were minorities, as I mentioned, but we were the dominant, overwhelming majority. We are now a minority community. Do you believe that? Do you feel that? Have you come to terms with that? Because I think one of the issues is, it's not just that we're a minority, it's that we are an ex-majority minority. You see, there are many parts of the world where Christians have always been a minority. That's been their experience all the way through. We are used to being a majority. We're used to thinking like a majority, talking like a majority, acting like a majority. We are an ex-majority minority, and that transition is difficult because we carry so much legacy with us. All of these are major transitions. From settlers to sojourners, it seems a bit odd. What do I mean by that? Well, simply that in Christendom, we felt at home. This was our society, shaped by the Christian story, with rhythms of life, rhythms of the year that were sort of imbued with Christianity. We felt like we were settlers. In post-Christendom, it's not like that. We feel much more like sojourners, travelers, aliens, pilgrims, strangers. Those are the words that are used a lot to describe our experience in a post-Christendom world. In the New Testament, there is a word, a Greek word, paroikos, which is used mainly by Peter. And paroikos can be translated as sojourner, or someone who travels alongside, or somebody who is part of the culture but not fully part. So a paroikos in the New Testament might be a Christian living in Ephesus, for example, who's a citizen of Ephesus, but actually their citizenship is in heaven. There's a sense of dual citizenship, a paroikos. That was the status of the early Christians. They didn't fully belong. They were there, committed to their community, but actually they had other allegiances. What's interesting about the word paroikos, I think, is we get the word parishioner from it. And a parishioner, of course, historically, is someone who's fully at home in their culture, who has rights within the parish. So the settling, throughout hundreds of years, the paroikos became the parishioner. We're moving back into the original paroikos, where we're not fully at home in our culture. From privilege to plurality. Understandably, because we were at the center, the dominant majority, we had enormous privileges. No other community could possibly enjoy the privileges that we had. But as we move into a post-Christendom plural society, those privileges are being eroded. We're losing the privileges that we are used to. And more disturbing for many people, other communities are now getting privileges and protections. I don't know if you've heard the frequent complaint, they'd never dare say about Muhammad what they say about Jesus on the radio. There's a sense in which other communities are being respected and protected, whereas, you know, we're up for grabs, basically. It's an interesting one. It means that there are quite a lot of cross Christians around, grumpy Christians, Christians who write letters of complaint about these things, and who basically are trying to hold on to the remaining privileges that we think we should enjoy. I'm not sure that's a particularly helpful strategy myself. And it does seem to me that in a plural society, if anything, we should be campaigning against remaining privileges. That to be in a plural society, it would be just for no community to have more privileges than the other. And for mission, it would be good to be on a level playing field. But that's not the kind of instinct in many of our churches, where we feel we need to hold on to our rights. Do you remember Jerry Springer, the opera, a few years ago? Some of you do, those of you old enough. Jerry Springer, the opera, caused an enormous storm of protest from many Christians. It seemed to be a play that was blasphemous, that was making a mockery of Jesus. And there was an enormous outburst of protest, which is entirely predictable. And part of the difficulty was that this was a satirical play and we didn't seem to get the joke, didn't seem to understand what was going on. What I found interesting was that at just the same time in Birmingham, there was another play which was deeply offensive to the Sikh community. I can't remember what it was called, but it was really offensive to the Sikh community. And I remember thinking at the time, I wonder what impact missionally we would have had as a Christian community if we just let the Jerry Springer thing go, but had complained about the damage, the disquiet, the distress being caused to our Sikh friends by this play. Would have been a strange response, but I think one of the things that we will need to learn in post-Christendom is how to be strange. One of my big concerns about Christendom, it was just so dull. It was just so conventional, so boring, and so unlike Jesus, who spent his whole life, it seems, confusing people and disturbing people. My mental picture of the disciples as they wandered around after Jesus was this. What's he doing? Jesus, don't say that to the Pharisees. You'll upset them. So I think one of the challenges in post-Christendom is to become again a surprising people. An early church historian, looking at the way in which the church grew in the first 200 or 300 years before Christendom, talks about fascination evangelism. There was something fascinating, surprising about the Christian community. And I want to ask the question, what today would surprise people in Thornbury that this church could do? Please hear me, I'm not talking about gimmicks. The last thing we need are gimmicks or programs. But what Jesus-shaped surprises might we offer to people? What countercultural ways of operating might actually make good news? One of the best books, I think, on evangelism over the last 20 years, it's been around for a while now, is Graham Tomlin's book, The Provocative Church. And essentially, he is saying one thing, and takes a whole book to say it. That's quite an art. As an author, I have some sympathy with that. But essentially what he's saying is we are moving into a context where people are not looking for us to give answers to questions they're asking. We sort of assume that people have got questions. The Alpha course is based on the idea that people have got questions and we've got answers for them. And we just need to get them into the place where we make sure they ask the right questions we've got the answers to. What Graham Tomlin is arguing is actually we need to provoke questions. We need to be a provocative community. which will actually encourage people to ask questions they hadn't thought of asking before. We'll come back to that. From control to witness, a fifth change. Christendom, as I mentioned, was a controlled society. It was dominant. And of course, we are way beyond that. And so we're thrown back on the earlier approach, which is witness, which is telling our story, inviting people into that story. Very briefly, the last two I'll put up together. We haven't got time to go into all of these, but these are different from the first five. The first five, I would suggest, are happening whether we like them or not. They are simply a description of some of the changes taking place in our culture. The last two seem to me to be important responses to that. A move from maintenance to mission in our churches, and a move from institution to movement. The Christendom Church was an enormous institution, and primarily focused on maintenance. Since it assumed everybody around was Christian anyway, no real place for mission. Nothing wrong with institution, nothing wrong with maintenance. They're not swear words. Any community needs a certain amount of maintenance and a certain amount of institution if it's to survive. But it's when that becomes overbearing, when that becomes dominant, then we're in trouble, especially as we move into this changing culture. And so I think one of the challenges for all of us as congregations, as movements, is to move away from an over-emphasis on institutional maintenance and to ask, what would it mean for this church to become a missional movement? How would that change things? What would that mean in terms of what you do and what you don't do, how you spend your time and resources? Let me pause there for a moment. Do you recognize that? Anything there that doesn't resonate? Have a quick chat with the person next to you. Yes, I know, I do this stuff. Quick chat with the person next to you, unless you really don't fancy that, and you know, find somebody else. Where have you seen this in your own context? Where does the rubber hit the road for you? What do you think about these things? Do you welcome them? Do you regret them? How are you engaging with them? Just for 3 or 4 minutes, a quick bit of conversation to stop me talking. Okay, let me draw you back together again. David has a microphone here, so if any of you have any comments, any feedback, reflections, this is your moment. Yep.
I was just reflecting on how unattractive it was to get caught up in maintaining institutions, and how actually, in some ways, if we lose some of that, maybe we lose a bit of burden as well. Because sometimes churches try to control us, or at least we worry that they're going to control us. And, you know, it's quite terrifying to walk into a church if you think you might get nabbed and put on rotas and given duties. And I think actually that puts a lot of people off even going to a church, the fear that they'll be sort of picked on in some way or another and getting themselves given jobs.
One of the rather strange features of the last few years has been the growth in cathedral congregations across the country. You know, these are the most Christendom places in the country. Why are they growing? Probably a number of reasons, but one of them, I think, is exactly what you're talking about. You aren't being nabbed for the flower rota for the next week. You can simply go, be anonymous, come in, go out, whatever. And I think one of the questions we do need to ask in our churches, as we move from majority to minority, is how busy do we want to be? And how much pressure are we putting on ourselves to maintain a program that was once sustainable but perhaps isn't, and perhaps isn't necessary in quite the same way? So maybe simplifying and streamlining could be part of our response to free up some more space for mission. Thank you. Okay, what other comments? Yeah, a couple of hands, three.
Mindful of what you've said about the way Christians react, I mean, I'm aware of reading a lot of articles of this slippery slope and how awful it is, and oh gosh, there's another thing that's going, and a number of, yeah. I can think of some Christian so-called, you know, organisations that are standing firm,
yeah.
kind of it feels for I wonder if you could just unpack that a bit more, because I rebel against that, but mm-hmm. I can kind of see where some of them are coming from, but I kind of just like you to expand really on what you're saying about that alternative or how we actually approach it.
I suppose it's a question of whether we are more concerned about what we see as our rights and our privileges, or about justice in a plural society, or about putting others before ourselves. I think Jesus says something about that at some point. It just worries me that if we become a community that has a reputation just for defending our own interests, that's not a particularly attractive or missional stance, I don't think. And it's not a question of being shy about what we believe. It's not a question of being unwilling to speak out for things that we think are important. But if it comes across as simply defending our own interests, I'm not sure that's a particularly helpful approach. Let me take you back a few years for an example of that. Do you remember Keep Sunday Special? You know, a last-ditch attempt to make sure the shops are shut on Sundays, because we know people really want to come to church. They're just being distracted by Tesco's being open when it shouldn't be, that kind of thing. And, you know, if we get all the shops shut, we're going to have huge congregations because people will have nothing else to do. They might as well come to church. You know, we know it's a nonsense, but it was almost presented in that way. What was difficult about that campaign was that there was a kind of consortium of trade unions, churches, groups concerned about the impact on families. There were some really quite important issues there. There were justice issues. There were issues to do with the family and to do with the health of society. The difficulty was that when Christians were asked to get involved in this, the strapline was, your Sunday is under threat. It wasn't, how can we make sure that families are supported? How can we make sure that people aren't exploited? It was, your Sunday is under threat. That's what's going to mobilize the Christians. It was self-interest again. It's that kind of thing. So even when we want to get involved in issues of justice and what's good for society, if we come across as those who have a special stake in this, I think we're in trouble. I think the difficulty again is its lack of surprise. You know, that was exactly what everybody expected the Christians to say. Keep Sunday Special. Yes, of course Christians will be up for that. In the middle of that campaign, I remember writing an article for a Christian magazine called Make Wednesday Special, which really irritated the Keep Sunday Special campaign. But what I wanted to try and say was, I think some of the aims of this campaign are good. You know, I think there are reasons why it's not good to have 24/7 shops open or whatever. But to tie it in to the Christian Sunday, I think is giving the wrong message. I chose Wednesday because I wasn't aware of any religious community for whom Wednesday was special. It just seemed to me to be a kind of way of working for justice in a plural society. It was a spoof article. They sadly took it rather seriously, but it's a risky take when you do spoofs. I don't know if that unpacks it fully, but you get the sort of thing I mean. Somebody else was... Somebody there? Then we'll have a quick move on.
Right, when you were going through that list, you said you were going to skip over the last two.
Yep.
I think maintenance to mission and institution to movement are so important.
Yeah.
You know, this building... our church at Wootton, why do we need the building? We need to be out there missioning. Mm-hmm. The institution is like keeping it as a club. Mm. We're looking inwards, we're looking at our own people, mm. rather than looking at those who are outside outside of us.
I didn't skip over them because they're unimportant, just because of lack of time, but I do regard them as crucially important. But again, to say that any community needs a certain amount of institution if it's going to survive beyond one generation. And there is good maintenance, you know, discipleship, community, being who we are together. That's important. It's when that becomes dominant. You know, if mission becomes 0.7b on the church agenda, we're in trouble. You know, once we've sorted out the preaching rota and the caretaker and all sorts of... Oh, it was mission. Oh, I haven't got time for that tonight. We'll do that next time. You know, there are churches for... I remember saying that just recently, and somebody was nodding vigorously. It happened. I think it was actually 0.7b as well, which was remarkable. No, mission is the agenda. It's not even 0.1 on the agenda. Mission's the agenda, and the maintenance and the institution is a way of serving our participation in God's mission. One more, and then let me move on a bit. But thank you.
So can I just come back to what you're saying about some self-interest?
Yeah.
So The self-interest presumably is interest in sort of continuing to demonstrate our Christian principles and belief. So when you say demonstrating self-interest, you're not looking at it from a social cohesion perspective. Because I'm struggling at the moment, you're saying about self-interest, when actually it's not particularly self-interest for me, it's my faith and my belief, which I may feel is under attack. And when you say that's not helpful, that's self-interest, are you looking at too much from the social cohesion perspective?
No, I think I'm looking at more from a missional perspective of asking, because the focus this evening very much is on how do we share good news in a changing society. And I think one of the things that most people think about Christians is that they're really wanting their way dominant in society still, you know, after hundreds of years. And everything we say and do that undergirds that suspicion, I think, is unhelpful in terms of mission. So I'm not in any way saying we should be apologetic about what we believe, whether that's theological or ethical or anything else. It's where we are wanting somehow to either enforce that or gain special treatment or special privileges. I mean, let me give you another example, which in a sense is a very marginal one, but it just illustrates it. The House of Lords, God bless them. At the moment, only Anglican bishops have seats by right in the House of Lords. Nobody else. Hindus? Nope. Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, Pentecostals, Catholics, Baptists? No. Only Anglicans, because of the state church link. Is that just in a plural society? No. Social cohesion? Maybe, but I think it's also a justice issue, that it will be helpful and Christian for there to be a wider representation. Now, there are actually Hindus, Buddhists, and Muslims there, but they're there for other reasons than their faith. Would it be better for Christians to campaign against only Anglican bishops in the House of Lords, rather than we ought to have Anglican bishops in the House of Lords? So that's the kind of point I'm making. Who cares about the House of Lords in one sense? But it's just an illustration of, do we hold on to what we've got, or do we actually need to find a more creative way? Okay, let's get on to the other part of this evening, which is implications for faith sharing. I don't know whether already you're beginning to think, oh, this might mean that for how I share my faith. Let me throw out a few ideas fairly briefly, and then it'd be good to have some conversation around that. There's one kind of foundational issue which I think we need to address. Do we still believe the gospel? Because if we don't, the rest is pretty much irrelevant. And I ask that quite seriously, because given that we're now maybe 6, 7, 8% of the population, has the gospel failed our society? Most people in our society see the church as a fading institution, Christianity as something that's been tried and failed. One author writes very poignantly about the death of Christian Britain. In the light of our society and its perceptions of us, what do we think? Do we really still believe in the gospel? Do we have confidence in the gospel still? I'm not going to answer that this evening, but I think we just need to ask that question genuinely. Do we believe the gospel is still good news? Have we got anything worth sharing with those around us? If we think we have, then I do think we have to take seriously the Christendom legacy, and that's why I've taken quite a bit of time on that this evening. Because many people know very little about the Jesus story, but a surprising number of people know quite a bit about the dark side of Christendom. Inquisition, Crusades, witch hunts, persecution. I don't know about you, but I quite often have conversations with people where that is the stumbling block, or at least that's the initial thing. A friend of mine is an enthusiast for Alpha. He's run Alpha courses very successfully for a number of years. He's also a very good cook, and so the meal is great, and people really enjoy being together. And he's done the Alpha thing, where you go through all these weeks. And one particular occasion, a little while ago, the group came to the end of Alpha, and they said to him, Daniel, could we carry on meeting? We've really enjoyed your hospitality. We've enjoyed the opportunity for these conversations. None of them are Christians. Could we meet again and ask the questions we want to ask now? Which I thought was quite perceptive. You know, they tweaked that Alpha is about getting you to ask the questions we want you to ask. And so Daniel rang me up and said, I've said yes. Would you come and do a couple of evenings with me? So I went over. And the first evening, we spent 2 hours talking about the issue of God and suffering, which I think you're going to be doing something on here, which was a fairly predictable one. The second evening was where one of them said, if what you're saying about Jesus is true, why has the church behaved so badly over the years? Now, I have to say, he used rather more colourful language than that, but, you know, I won't inflict that on you this evening. And he'd asked that question before to Christians and had been fobbed off. Excuses. Oh, well, they weren't really Christians or whatever else it was. And we took two and a half hours really exploring that with him. And I've learned that that's a question that many people have. They may not want 2.5 hours worth of answer, but they want to ask questions about it. The Christendom legacy is something we've got to grapple with. We need to think through how we're going to respond to that. And part of the answer may simply be to say, you're right, and we're really sorry. We're really sorry that over the centuries we have represented Jesus so badly in some of those ways. We need to think about how we're going to deal with that. In a plural society where we have many different groups, secular, religious, spiritual, other religions, there is no one gospel formula. There is no one way of presenting the gospel that's going to work for every person. And so I would suggest the first part of evangelism now is listening. It probably always has been, but certainly now. We need to listen. We need to understand where people are coming from. We need to enter into people's worldviews. You know, the classic evangelist is someone who speaks without listening, or only stops speaking long enough to draw breath. Now, that isn't post-Christendom evangelism. We will need to listen much more carefully. And the reason that we struggle with that sometimes is we're not outside of church culture long enough, which again goes back to busyness. Maybe we need to spend more time out there. We will also need to start further back. One of the disadvantages of Alpha, which has many positive things about it, is it starts a long way down the road for many people. It assumes all sorts of beliefs already. We will need pre-Alpha courses and pre-pre-Alpha courses and pre-pre-pre-Alpha courses as we move further into post-Christendom. We'll need to start a lot further back, and it will take longer, and we'll need to be patient. For most people, they're a long, long way from believing at the moment. And so unrealistic expectations will just discourage us. We will need to journey with people for a long time. We'll also need to learn to speak sensitively. Our tone of voice matters. And that's coming back to this majority-minority thing. You know, the majority voice is big and brash and triumphalistic. And it sounds awfully hollow when you're a minority community. And so our tone of voice is really quite important. Humble, gentle, winsome, not domineering. How we speak is going to be important, I think. And maybe, again, provoking questions rather than trying to give answers. One of the things I really like about Jesus is he doesn't answer many questions. He asks a lot, but he hardly answers any. You ask Jesus a question, he tells you a story you don't understand, or a riddle that you have to try and work out, or he asks you a question in return. He must have been so irritating. You ask him this question, you don't get an answer. Maybe that was because Jesus wanted people to think through what they were asking, wanted them to question their own worldviews. Maybe in post-Christendom, evangelism is more about listening carefully, speaking humbly, and asking good questions, rather than thinking we've got to give the answer. And back again to what I was talking about earlier, about living provocatively. How can we surprise people? How can we provoke people to ask questions? What is it about the way we might live? Because that was how the early church did it. It was the kind of people they invited to supper that surprised people. It was the way in which they went against all the expectations of their society. It made them unpopular. All sorts of accusations were leveled against them, but people sat up and took notice. And one of the legacies of Christendom, I think, is this boredom, this dullness, this conventionality. I wonder what it means for us to be a provocative church. Maybe that's a question you could ask here. What would it mean for you to be a provocative church here in Thornbury? What would make your neighbours sit up and take notice? And one area that I wonder about in particular is the whole issue of peace. David mentioned earlier that I come from the Anabaptist tradition, which for nearly 500 years has embraced peace witness. Has said that followers of Jesus, the Prince of Peace, should be peaceful, should be committed to nonviolence. We're very conscious, I'm sure, of being in a world that is conflicted, that is violent, that is unjust. And the dominant culture is basically committed to what we can call redemptive violence. Most of our blockbuster films are based on the notion of redemptive violence. The best way to get justice is for the good guys to win by whatever means. And so violence is a means to a good end. And that is a lie that has been dominant in our society for a very, very long time. And the peace witness of the early church, the peace witness of minority communities through the Christendom era, says, actually, no, this is not the way of Jesus. Justice is important, but violence just produces a cycle of violence. Maybe one of the most provocative things we could do in a violent society is to be unapologetically committed to peace. What would it mean to be a peace church? A church that is learning the ways of reconciliation, learning how to deal with conflict well, learning how to offer alternative approaches that are non-violent to situations of conflict. There are Christians across the world who are exploring that, and I think their witness is pretty powerful. I don't know whether that's an issue you've thought about at all, but it seems to me that it may be one of those areas where if the church can really embrace and learn how to work in the ways of peace, that could be very good news for our society. Let me finish with this, and then we've got 10 minutes or so for some further conversation. I used to have a poster on my wall. It got sadly destroyed in the move 18 months ago. But it was described as a modest proposal for peace. And it simply said this: let the Christians of the world agree that they will not kill each other. A modest proposal for peace. Okay, you can hate each other, you can fall out with each other, you can thump each other, but you won't actually kill each other. Terry, do you reckon you and I could make that agreement? We're not going to kill each other? Whatever the provocation? Yeah? Yeah, we might fall out, we might dislike each other, you know, but we're not going to kill each other. Yeah? You going to kill Mary? Okay, I won't push that too far. Do you think as a congregation you could make that commitment to each other? That however much you disagree with each other about the choice of songs on a Sunday morning or where the chairs go, you're not going to kill each other. You might argue, you might fight, but no, you're not going to kill each other. It's a minimal sort of commitment, isn't it? A modest proposal for peace. What about the URC church down the road? Would you kill one of them? Or the Anglicans? Or the Catholics? How far does the ripple spread out? What about if you are in the military and you go to war against another country where you know there might be Christians? What would you do then? Do you have a different commitment to the global Christian community than to your own fellowship? And if so, why? And of course, why should you only not kill Christians? You know, is it fine to kill Muslims? That's okay. You know, they're not part of us anyway. They're different. The more you think about this modest proposal, the more the ripples spread out. And you begin to think, well, actually, probably, when Jesus said, love your enemies, he probably meant we shouldn't kill them. He might mean a bit more than that, but that's sort of kind of base level, isn't it? Probably shouldn't be killing them. And yet, the Christendom legacy is of a church that was violent, that embraced violence, that used violence, that endorsed violence, that taught that violence was God's will in all kinds of situations. I think it's part of the legacy that we need to repent of and we need to acknowledge, because for many people that is part of the barrier. A wealthy, coercive, violent church. We need somehow to find a way of breaking free of that. David, do you want to rove around again with that microphone? What are your reflections on any of those things or anything else? In the light of what we've been talking about this evening, what does this mean for sharing the gospel?
Nick, you waited till I got right across the other side.
That's the arch. You need to sort of move him from side to side as much as you can.
I'm going to have to look up the word in the dictionary. Provocative, it sounds rather aggressive. I've done things with Through Faith Mission, and you don't put anything to anybody, you're asking questions all the time. If you put awkward things to them, the barriers go up. It's just that word is a bit awkward.
Yeah. Is there a better word, do you think?
I can't think of it.
Questioning? Challenging? No, I take the point. And I'm not using provocative in that kind of way. It's much more trying to stimulate a response of some kind.
It's just opening space.
Gentle provocation. Yeah.
Intriguingly.
Okay, that's an interesting word. Yes. Okay, I might use that rather than provocative. Intriguing. Fascination was the other word that I used earlier. Fascinating, which is quite nice, I think.
There's a huge demand in the world today for people to listen. Listen to me and, you know, speak sensitively to me and live in peace with me. And so often those demands that I hear a lot in the media, especially the left-wing media, are associated with liberal Christianity. And so I would associate liberal Christianity, without wishing to get myself into too much hot water here, with those kinds of things. But the flip side of that might be that some of the message gets a bit diluted. So I wonder if I can ask you, looking at the things that you've mentioned, how do we do that in a way that retains the completeness of the evangelical message and doesn't go far down into the, it's all right, it doesn't really matter, I'm going to listen to you, I'm going to be sensitive to you, I'm never going to judge you, I'm never going to give you anything that might cause you to be a little bit provoked.
I just think it's a question of priority, really. I'm not in any way suggesting we shouldn't be talking about Jesus. In fact, I think we need to talk a lot more about Jesus, really, because one of the things I'm interested in is that many people are utterly turned off by the church, but are still fascinated by Jesus. I have a rather strange collection of anecdotes of atheists who love Jesus. It's a really weird thing, isn't it? But people who would declare themselves to be atheists, but who would use the word love. I love Jesus. I think he's fantastic. I think he's wonderful. So I think we need to talk about Jesus a lot. But I think we need to start by listening. We need to recognize how many barriers there are to overcome before you get to that point. And sometimes we just need to take it for a while. The danger is if you start talking what you want to talk about too soon, people don't feel they've been heard. And sometimes I think we just need to wait until people have exhausted themselves. Way of relaxing, I play table tennis. I play league table tennis, which I find great fun. But I was used to play in the Bristol League, but we've now moved. But I was playing with somebody here in Bristol a couple of years ago now, just practicing. And he knew I was a Christian. And he decided he wanted to not only knock the ball over the net to me, but he wanted to throw all kinds of things at me. And essentially, he spent about half an hour while we were knocking the ball backwards and forwards, telling me what was wrong with the church. And it was largely the legacy of Christendom. And it became very clear to me that he wasn't going to listen to anything I said. So, okay, I just listened. I mean, I said one or two things, but very little. What was interesting was the next time we played, he wanted to talk again, but this time he wanted to listen. There's still things he wanted to say, but it was a conversation. And I just think we need to have the patience and the courage to let people let off steam, which is often what it is, to raise the concerns and the questions and the objections. If we jump in too quickly, I think we will miss opportunities. So it's not about being shy of the message. It's timing. It's about when we speak. And I just think in a minority community, it's not quite we need to earn the right to speak. We don't. But we need to provide a context within which people can actually listen to us as well as listen to them. Does that help at all? Okay, well, I hear the challenge, yes. You know, there's a danger we only ever listen, and I don't think that's what I'm saying, but I do think probably we need to prioritise listening for the time being.
Interesting, talking about living provocatively, that brought to mind, and it's quite completely opposite to what some of you were saying over there. I worked in an Islamic school for quite a few years, and so I've got a lot of Islamic friends, and I got invited to a mosque to break fast at the end of Ramadan. Mm. And without sounding racist, I was the only white person in the mosque at the time. And I felt, I didn't say anything. And I just think they all knew that I was a Christian. But I think we should go out in society and just sit and be invited out. Mm. And I didn't say anything to anybody, but I think that spoke more. Yeah. The preparedness to sit and listen and watch and understand and not believe or you see on TV, I think that's living provocatively.
Yes, and it's a good example of a Christian being a guest rather than the host. You know, I think in Christendom we've been the host and invited people to come to us all the time. And I think one of the challenges is to learn to be a guest, to be in other places where people perhaps feel less comfortable. I don't know how comfortable you felt in the mosque, but yeah, but you're, and you were well hosted, no doubt. But there are many places we might find ourselves where we're far less comfortable, but it's good to be there. If I can just briefly tell a story, it is about a mosque. Some colleagues of mine, several years ago now, in fact, it was the morning after 9/11, which I guess many of us remember. It's one of those things you remember where you were that day, don't you? A couple of friends of mine in East London, in Tower Hamlets, who for a part of a mission team, who for the past couple of years had been volunteering in a Muslim youth club. So rather than setting up a Christian youth club, they'd been volunteering as Christians in a Muslim youth club. And so they were known by the Muslim community. And the morning after 9/11, they just thought, we've got to do something. We don't know what to do. We've got to do something. And they simply wandered along and stood outside the big East London mosque on Whitechapel Road. One of them's quite small and skinny. The other is much bigger than me, bald head. You know, he looks like real trouble. Standing outside a mosque on the morning after 9/11, he hadn't thought it through, I don't think. But what was interesting, they didn't know what they wanted to do. They just wanted in some way to reach out to the Muslim community because already there was antagonism against the local community. And what happened was that one of the young people that they'd known through the youth club recognized them and said, oh, Jim, Arthur, come in. Okay. Introduced them to the imam, and they explained that they were there as followers of Jesus, deeply saddened by what had happened, but wanting to extend a hand of friendship and to say we don't blame all Muslims for what happened the day before. The imam then invites them, to their surprise, to address the congregation that morning after 9/11. Now, that for me is a part of the answer to your question. It had taken 2 years of building relationships and listening very gently. It opened up an opportunity which they couldn't have imagined, to speak about Jesus, the Prince of Peace, in a mosque the morning after 9/11. That's the kind of unusual situation we're going to find ourselves in post-Christendom. But it's built on relationship, it's built on patience, I think.